This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. An ISU researcher is looking for possible clues to longevity, and it starts in B cells.
We know that people who are born without B cells have a very severe infection early in life.
Illinois State University scientist Laura Vogel tells GLT's Judy Valente why turtles and B cells matter. Get an update on the rapidly growing brewery and tap room scene from special beer correspondent Ryan Denham. He checks in with the brewers behind Keg Grove Brewery right off the Constitution Trail. And Laura Kennedy brings you an Oscars preview from GLT culture maven Sherry Zeck. That and a GLT News update on the way. It's March 2nd, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Some scientists call B cells the unsung heroes of the human body. B cells are white blood cells that help ward off viruses and infection. As our bodies age, so does the effectiveness of these cells. Illinois State University immunology professor Laura Vogel has spent years studying B cells and will report on her work Tuesday evening at Illinois State University. Vogel tells GLT's Judy Valente why research on turtles might hold the key to understanding how B cells can continue to thrive in humans.
My lab in particular is interested in studying the function of these B cells as you age. And it's long been known that as we get older, our immune system function declines. We are more susceptible to things like infection and cancer. And we look at the numbers of cells. They don't really change much in our older years, but the function declines. We call that immunosenescence. It's almost like the cells have fallen asleep.
Is there anything that we can do about that? There's some way to rejuvenate these cells.
That is what my lab is interested in studying. We are interested in finding out if there is a therapy or a molecule or a replacement that we can give to people in older years to help their immune system work better. So we're particularly interested in B cells and antibody protection in kind of your gut. So thinking about foodborne illnesses or illnesses that you might get from the air. So things in the respiratory tract and ways that we might be able to improve the B cells and antibody function in your older age to help protect you.
Are there other cells in the body that function like the B cells, or do they serve kind of a unique purpose?
B cells are the only cells in your body that can make the antibody molecules, and they're very important. We know that people who are born without B cells have a very severe infection early in life. So if you've heard of the bubble boy or children who have to live in sterile environments, that's because they lack these B cell and antibody molecules. So we know that this function is really important. It's unique to B cells, and that's one of the reasons we think they're sort of the unsung heroes of the immune system.
Now, you're studying these cells for perhaps applications against illnesses in old age. Would you inject these cells into people? How would you get the cells into people? Through pills? How would that happen?
Good. So some of our research is involved with trying to identify which type of B cell might be defective. We have different types of B cells in our body. And so by identifying what cells are not functional or what molecules are missing, we might be able to make a drug therapy and fix the B cells that you already have. Or there are other groups that are looking at replacing those cells. Could we just give you a transplant of some kind to replace the defective cells and have the new cells established in an older individual? So both things, we're trying different approaches.
Where would you get the B cells? Would you get them from stem cells or umbilical cords?
There are lots of different ways you could generate B cells for a cell type therapy. That's farther down the road. Right now we're trying to more find what kinds of defects there are, but we could generate them from a bone marrow stem cell. Those are the cells that replenish basically your entire immune system, so all the different kinds of white blood cells. We might even be able to replace cells by just purifying B cells, say, from a blood donation from a young individual, and then give you B cells that have already been formed that way. So there's lots of different possibilities, and we're excited about what the future holds.
In looking at some of the research you've done, you're working with turtles of all animals because they have longevity. How does the turtle fit into all of this research?
My original research and training was in biomedical immunology. So we were studying the mouse as a model system for humans. When I came to ISU, one of my colleagues is an ecological physiologist, Dr. Rachel Bowden, and she happened to be studying turtles. And as we got to talking about our different model systems, we realized, hey, the turtle is also a very long-lived animal. They live in an environment where they're constantly challenged by pathogens, so they can get sick very frequently. But we rarely see a sick turtle, and we didn't know very much at all about how immune function works in reptiles. So this was a great area for us to begin studying, and we've made some really unique discoveries and hope to continue that research.
What are some of the discoveries?
We have investigated B cells in the turtle, so we didn't know very much about what tissues in the turtle the B cells are found. We also have been looking a lot at their antibody molecules, and we were able to discover for the first time that B cells in turtles actually have a special function. They are phagocytic, and that means that they engulf and digest pathogens. So I like to think of that as like a Pac-Man. Mm-hmm. They kind of go around and gobble up the bacteria or viruses that might be in your body and digest them. For people, this B cell function was thought to be just making antibody molecules. So to have this extra phagocytic function in B cells was new in reptiles. And not very long after our lab made that discovery, they did go back and find a subset of B cells in people that actually had that same phagocytic capability. So it was a very exciting discovery for us.
You're also studying mice pretty heavily, too. What do you learn from the mice?
So the mouse is the more traditional model for immunology. A lot of what we find in research in the mouse model translates directly to human medicine. The mouse has been studied for over 100 years, so we know a lot about the genetics and the tissues and the cells that are in the mouse, and they age faster. So in our research, we use a mouse that is about 18 months old, which is equivalent to a 65 to 75-year-old person. So it allows us to do research that might not otherwise be possible during a compacted time scale.
You mentioned cancer. You mentioned some viral diseases. What about AIDS? AIDS comes to mind to me when you talk about immune diseases.
So AIDS is caused by the HIV virus, and it infects specifically a type of white blood cell called a T cell. T cells are really important to help our B cells make antibodies. So people who progress to AIDS and their T cell numbers start to go down do have a decrease in antibody function. It's not necessarily directly related to aging, but it is certainly related to that loss of immune function and an inability to produce B cells.
So your research into B cells could help people who are HIV positive or who have full-blown AIDS ultimately?
For what we are studying right now, we are looking at basic mechanisms of how antibodies are produced. So certainly if we have some findings in the turtle of different immune strategies that they might use, maybe different cells or molecules that are involved, that could very easily translate to some new therapy that might even just generally protect against viruses in people.
How far away are we from being able to use this research or really apply it to some of the diseases that we know of?
Our research is what's considered basic immunology research, so we are investigating things at sort of the molecular and cell level to understand how the antibodies are produced and how the B cells recognize when an infection is present. So we are, the sorts of research that we do would translate into clinical findings down the road, maybe something that another lab might be interested in or a pharmaceutical company, for example, to develop then into that human product. in general, it probably takes 10 to 15 years from the time something is identified as a potential target in a basic research lab for it to actually hit the market.
So one of the hopes might be that a pharmaceutical company then picks up on this research and tries to create a medication that goes along with this?
So certainly we have been working on trying to identify different kinds of molecules or the cell therapy that I mentioned earlier to see if that might be a viable option. And this isn't so far-fetched thinking of the turtle research. Researchers have recently found new immune molecules in Komodo dragons and in crocodiles that they're trying to turn into now biopharmaceutical compounds to replace maybe antibiotics or to help with antibiotics. So, you know, certainly down the road, we hope that some of these findings will prove something that that a drug company would be interested in or be able to go into clinical practice.
Laura Vogel is a professor of immunology in the School of Biological Sciences at ISU studying B cells. Thanks so much for talking about this fascinating subject.
Thank you.
I'm Judy Valente.
Vogel gives the spring distinguished lecture for ISU's College of Arts and Sciences. Her talk, A Fantastic Voyage, B-Cells, the Unsung Heroes of the Immune System, is at 7 p.m. Tuesday in the Old Main Room of the Bone Student Center. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Brad Barker Honda, working with car buyers to match them with quality, reliable vehicles suited to their lifestyles and budgets. Veterans Parkway and GE Road in Bloomington or online at bradbarkerhonda.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Coming up, it's an update on the growing brewery scene in Bloomington Normal. Ryan Denham has the story ahead during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Big changes to Illinois' gun laws don't happen often, but a growing movement across the country appears to be resonating in the state's General Assembly. IPR's Daisy Contreras has the report.
Hundreds rallied outside the State House calling for stricter gun control. Several in attendance had lost loved ones to gun violence. They wore pins showing the faces of the deceased. Mary Kay Mays lost her daughter when a gunman opened fire in a Northern Illinois University classroom. The recent high school shooting in Florida happened on the 10th anniversary of her daughter's death.
We are piling anniversaries of mass shootings on other mass shootings' anniversaries. How many other countries can say that?
Advocates focused on one measure they want to see passed in particular. It's an idea that has been floated unsuccessfully for over a decade and would require gun dealers be licensed. They say that would make them more accountable. Not everyone agrees with that approach. Here's Savannah GOP Representative Tony McCombie.
Guns do not kill people. People kill people. This bill is not going to change that.
Instead, many Republicans and some Democrats say the proposals are ill-considered and were put together too quickly. They argue the rights of law-abiding gun owners could be infringed. But two high-profile voices of support for gun control made the trip to Springfield from Chicago.
And so I urge the General Assembly, in a bipartisan way, to listen to the voices of our young people.
You know, and it's just time that we stop talking about this stuff and actually do something about it.
That's Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson, and before him, Chicago Cardinal Blaise Cupich. Both say action must happen within the state while federal leaders mull over what they will do. Governor Bruce Rauner wasn't on hand, but he said he thinks any regulatory changes should happen at the federal level. Seven different gun safety measures were slated for votes, but only a few actually advanced, including one to prohibit anyone under 21 from purchasing so-called assault rifles. I'm Daisy Contreras. Sam Dunklaw picks up the story in the Illinois House where most of the action took place.
Lawmakers debated for several hours while mothers from the earlier rally looked on from the gallery and cheered. Some ideas have broad support. Republican Representative David Harris of Arlington Heights favored a bump stock ban, saying the device's ability to make a rifle into an automatic weapon makes it too dangerous to be legal.
It ought to be banned in Illinois, and this is our chance to do it.
Last fall, the shooter in Las Vegas used a bump stock. Still, the attempt to pass a ban on it in Illinois failed to get enough support in the House back then. This time was different. Regulating gun dealers is also an idea that's been considered for years without getting approval. After sparring back and forth on it for 2 hours, the vote was in.
With 64 voting yes, 52 voting no, and 0 voting present, Senate Bill 1657 is declared passed.
Of all the gun legislation under consideration, that proposal is the first to go to the governor's desk. While some other states are considered better strongholds of the gun rights lobby, in Illinois, it's been able to fight off many past attempts at gun control. Yet the shock of the Florida school shooting and advocacy efforts that have followed appear to be resonating in many state houses. In Illinois, supporters of gun control say they've made it clear they won't settle for partial victories, and say those who don't go along will pay a price in the election.
Throw them out! Throw them out! Throw them out!
I'm Sam Dunklaw.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. Sound Ideas. Hollywood will honor its best this weekend at the Academy Awards. This in the face of the scandal and disillusion that have swamped much of the film industry. Activists have tried to call attention to inequality at the Academy Awards, as well as sexual abuse throughout the industry by wielding the modern weapon of choice, social media. Laura Kennedy spoke with GLT's culture maven to see if at the Oscars the hashtag is as important as the envelope, and if the much-loved awards show will be dented by the scandals.
Criticism regarding the lack of racial and gender diversity in the nominees for the Oscar has dogged the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences for years, taking the form of hashtags, Oscars so white, Oscars so male. But can social media shaming actually work? Sherry Zeck, interim dean of Milner Library at Illinois State University, and GLT's culture maven says real change can happen at the Oscars, but it will take more than Twitter.
Well, I think the Oscars so white certainly brought attention to something that was very, very wrong. I don't know if it was the hashtag itself, but certainly all the activity and all the talk around that issue, of which the hashtag was one part. I kind of wonder now, though, there are so many hashtags, there's no room in Twitter for actual text. I think that we might be in a kind of overload situation right now, where people want to write something and then they feel, well, I've got to do this and I've got to add this and I've got to hashtag that. And I think we might be reaching the point of overload, so that it's more of an obligation than actually an acknowledgement or a bit of activism.
So looking at the nominations of what we have this year, do you think the Academy took it to heart that they needed to have more diversity within their ranks and therefore within their nominees?
I think there are a number of things going on. First of all, for many, many years, the Academy was really dominated by people much older. The voting members of the Academy were much older. Well, frankly, a lot of those folks have died or are dying, and the age of voters is coming down. So, I mean, now somebody like Reese Witherspoon is old hat, right? And she's, what, 38 or something? So the demographic is getting younger within the Academy. There is generally more acknowledgement of problems with sexism and racism within the Academy. Look at the films that have come out. So the films are putting pressure on the Academy as well. There are a lot more African Americans and women who are getting their films made, getting them distributed, and getting them out there in front of a public that is appreciative. So all of those things are putting pressures on the Academy to change. Now, we can say that, and yet we look at the Best Director category, and there's still one woman in the category.
Yeah, that was Greta Gerwig.
Right.
For Lady Bird.
Right.
I hate California. I want to go to the East Coast.
I want to go where culture is, like
how
New
in the
York.
World did I raise such
or
a
at least
snob.
Connecticut or New Hampshire, really? Where writers live in the
get
woods.
Get into those schools anyway.
Mom!
You should just go to City College. You know, with your work ethic, just go to City College and then to jail and then back to City College and then maybe you'd learn to pull yourself up and not expect...
Which I have high hopes for in that category, but I think she's probably not going to win, but I have high hopes for that, in part because it seems like the right moment for another woman to win in the directing category.
Do you think overall women have done better this time with the Oscars? Have we seen more acknowledgement across the board? I mean, I'm thinking about Mary J. Blige, who not only got a nod for acting, but also for original song as well. So are we seeing more women getting nominated in areas like cinematography and so forth?
Not really. I mean, it's very limited. The tipping point has always been the directing category, in my view. Women actors are always featured and cool people come in and cool people go away and all that. But the directing category is where there have been very few female nominees and only one winner. And again, we have Greta Gerwig here. I liked Lady Bird tremendously. It's one of my favorite films of the year, but I don't think it's a spectacular example of directing.
Okay, now wait a minute. You don't think maybe that she's just a token then?
I don't think she's just a token. It is a strong film, and it's not unusual for strong films generally, ones that are in the best film category, to also carry the director along with them. But I think maybe 5 years ago, this wouldn't have happened. So it's not a token. It's a little bit of a change, maybe, that something gets the nod for best film, and the director, even though she's a woman, also shows up in the best directing category. But I don't think she's necessarily going to win, although I have hopes.
You're a big fan of the film Wonder Woman that came out last summer. Now, that was a fun movie, a great fun movie, but it did not rack up a bunch of nominations. Do you think that was fair? That was not a snub?
Well, first of all, big action films like that tend not to get into the big categories.
They get special effects, maybe costumes.
Song, costumes, special effects, production design possibly. So I'm sort of surprised it's not on here for editing or something, but I'm not surprised that it's not in any of the big categories.
Because it was a splashy, fun movie, not a serious movie, that the Academy, no matter what age group, no matter what demographic we have, they still embrace the serious movies then.
Pretty much, yep.
What do you think of Jordan Peele? He's an African-American director. Do you feel that his film Get Out is going to get an Oscar?
I don't. I have to confess, I've not seen the film because I don't do scary.
Get out.
Sorry, man.
Get out!
Yo! Rose, we gotta go.
Is everything okay?
Rose, the keys. Just get the keys.
Oh, I see.
And it looks...
Rose?
Unbelievably scary.
Okay.
Perhaps quite politically important scary, but unbelievably scary. I just watched the preview and put that on my list of no way. Absolutely not. Let's see. Mind control, zombies, and African Americans getting killed systematically. Nope, not going there.
But
anyway,
will the Academy go there?
No.
Really?
No, they're not going to go there for best film. Possibly for best director. The buzz is that he's pretty well liked and pretty well thought of. So maybe in the directing category, but not for best film.
Of course, not too long ago, we talked about the Weinstein effect and what's going on in Hollywood. And of course, the hashtags Me Too and Time's Up. And everybody's very focused on the issue of inappropriate behavior, and there's a lot of it out there to talk about. And one of the people who's been accused recently of sexual harassment is Casey Affleck, and he won Best Actor last year. Mm-hmm. It's traditional at the Oscars for the guy who won Best Actor to present the next year, the Best Actress Award. He has already said he's pulled out. He's not going to be presenting this year.
Well, I think pretty soon we're going to be in a situation where Tom Hanks is the only man who appears on stage.
They'll have to resurrect Gregory Peck.
Oh, Gregory Peck. You know I love Gregory Peck. I don't think that this is a sign of the future, unfortunately, because we are seeing so many people and their bad behavior being exposed that we are a nation of short attention spans. And we are a nation that is easily overloaded when we hear the same thing over and over again. And so Me Too has done great things, but maybe not by next year, but within a couple of years. I'm not saying we're going to go back to the way things were. Not saying that at all. But I think it will stop being on everybody's mind. So far, by and large, when men have been accused of bad behavior, they have disappeared from public view, or they've kind of done a mea culpa and then gotten out of the way. I think we're going to see more denials. I think we're going to start seeing more people saying, I was just flirting, come on, it was not a big deal. We're going to see more pushback. As a wise man once said, the arc of history is long, but it bends toward justice. It's really long. It's not a perfect arc. It's got ripples in it. So we're going to see some backlash and some backtracking from Me Too, I think.
Did Casey Affleck do the right thing in pulling out, do you think, of presenting at the Oscars?
The right thing morally? The right thing morally would have been not to behave badly. He pulled out of the Oscars because he doesn't want to be publicly excoriated. No moral win for him there. That was self-preservation.
So do you want to stick your neck out and make a prediction about Best Picture this year? Because, my goodness, there's some good nominees. The nominees are?
The Post, The Shape of Water, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, Call Me by Your Name, Darkest Hour, Dunkirk. How did that get in there? Get Out, Lady Bird, and Phantom Thread. And, you know, when the Oscars went to 10 nominees, I rolled my eyes because sometimes there's not five good ones in a year. This is the first year since they went to 10 that I thought, yeah, these are great films. And this year, I think we're really seeing what the addition of more nominees has been able to do for some somewhat smaller films in getting them some purchase in the audience base. Something like Lady Bird or The Shape of Water. Those are films that may, if we were just talking five, may not have made it there. But having made it into the Best Picture category, great buzz, great movies, they're doing fairly good box office, and their stars are doing well. And so here this year, I think we're really seeing some good come out of this, additional nominees. What do I want to pick? I may be the craziest person in the world, but I think it's going to be Three Billboards.
Well, now, why is that crazy? Because it did very well at the Golden Globes.
It did very well at the Golden Globes, but there's a lot of affection for The Shape of Water. Get Out has a following. Call Me by Your Name has a following. All things considered, I just think it's a winner. It's got a great script, great cast, enough controversy to make it interesting. It's a very, very good movie. So I'm putting my bet on that. But I do want to say something about The Post. If you look at this list here, The Post is the outlier. Because it's a film that 30 years ago we would have said, it's going to win Best Picture. And I don't think it has a chance.
Why?
Good script, good acting, good director, topical, well-made. I think it's like a well-made play of the 40s. We're tired of them. We want something that's got more of an edge, more bite. Just having all the right elements and doing everything very well, that's not going to pop through against something like, with this, again, with a slightly younger demographic of voters in the Academy, that's not going to pop through next to Get Out, Three Billboards, maybe even The Shape of Water.
That's GLT culture maven Sherry Zeck. She's the interim dean of Milner Library at Illinois State University. The Oscars are live this Sunday evening from the Dolby Theater in Los Angeles. I'm Laura Kennedy.
For the record, Zek thinks Gary Oldman will win Best Actor Oscar because it's unwise to bet against anyone playing Winston Churchill. You're listening to Oscar-nominated music composed by Hans Zimmer from the movie Dunkirk, and you're hearing it on GLT's Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A lot of beer enthusiasts try making it themselves, maybe picking up cheap home brewing kits and having some fun in the garage. For neighbors Jeffrey Mraz and Mike Hoff, their passion for home brewing didn't stop at their home. They're about to open Keg Grove Brewery in Bloomington, the fourth local tap room to open in just the past year. GLT's Ryan Denham asked Mraz, who is a Unit 5 teacher, when his home brewing hobby became something more.
You know, it kind of came over time. It was people that tasted it, people that were over hanging out with us. It was their reactions. It was their responses. You know, for me personally, it's about breaking the rules, really. I like just proving that I can do something sometimes. That sounded a little arrogant, but I don't mean it that way. More so in the, you know, you just experiment with something different. Like, I remember a couple times going to buy ingredients and Brian would be like, "You can't do that." "Well, I'm going to sure try." Hopefully they turned out all right. But I mean, it really came down to those people that we were surrounded by and just kept believing in us. And there came a point in time, about a year and a half ago, that it became serious. And we had a couple people really strongly believe in us. And we had some more serious conversations with our wives and our families. And, you know, we did some fact-finding, if you will, and we said, yeah, we can do this, and we went for it.
And the three of us are sitting here at a table in the middle of what will be your new brewery. It's a commercial building not far from the Illinois Wesleyan campus here on Empire Street. And it looks like you're going to have a second floor space, too, which is kind of unique for a tap room in our area. Why don't you describe just kind of the floor plan so folks can kind of visualize this?
The lower floor, as you walk in the door, there will be the main bar will be to the left, so we'll have 10 to 12 seats at the bar there, then we'll have our taps on the south wall. And then as you walk through the space, it's like a one-story space, but you walk another 20 feet and then it opens up to being two stories tall. Immediately in front of you, you'll see the whole brew system. So there'll be a brew system, all the fermenters and the bright tanks, all visible and open to the public. There will be a divider wall so they can't go back there, but it'll all be visible. There'll be some seating on the lower floor, and then there'll be a staircase up to a mezzanine where we'll have additional seating up there.
So why'd you settle on this location in particular? What'd you like about this building and this spot?
The location and ambiance, being so close to the trail, to the heart of the city, it's really centralized to the area. And just the ambiance of the building. When we walked in and we saw the openness in the main area and we saw the mezzanine, and like you said, there's not a lot of places that have that option. And just kind of had character. It had that classic character. It used to be a lumberyard back in the day, and we just like that history. It kind of ties in with our name and who we are. And
yeah, tell me a little bit about the history here of the name Keg Grove Brewery.
It's pretty historical to the area. Legend has it, and once again I want to stress legend, that some trappers were passing through the area back in the day, and they stashed a keg somewhere in the grove. We hope it was beer, but it was most likely whiskey or rum. And then they left it there, went about their travels, and Kickapoo Indians came across it and had a nice old time with it. And then from then forward, it was known as Keg Grove. The whole area was known as Keg Grove, and then it was changed to Blooming Grove and then Bloomington as it was settled further.
We've talked a lot about the taproom aspect of this, but In terms of the brewery operation, I mean, are you guys anticipating selling to bars, yes. Bottling and selling those? What are your expectations on that side?
Well, initially, we'll be marketing to some bars and restaurants. It's going to be a fine line, kind of a balancing act, making sure that we've got enough here in the tap room to fulfill the needs here in-house. But we'd love to be on tap at bars and restaurants locally. Down the way, we see ourselves pushing out probably cans, but that's another big capital investment. So that'll be a little ways down the road. But initially, we'll probably have growlers and crowlers to go. Maybe not day one, but within the first couple months. So that'll be our first packaged product out the door, and we'll just kind of grow from there and see. You know, see what the community supports us and see where things go.
Bloomington Normal has, I think, three other tap rooms right now, if you consider the beer hall distill a tap room. So you guys would be number four. I want to ask, like, what do you want to become your calling card, your reputation as people, as once you guys open, what do you want to be known for? Keg Grove.
We really want to be a part of this community. We want to work intricately with the community in many different ways. But I'd say also, as far as the beer goes, we have a decent amount of beers that we feel are like gateway beers, beers that really help people to get into craft beer. I mean, craft beer is a huge market right now, but there's still a lot of people that haven't gotten into it and are kind of afraid. I mean, a close friend of ours that works with us all the time couldn't handle hops for the longest time. And I'm proud to say he's finally on a pale ale. That's pretty exciting. I'd say between the gateway beers, our involvement with the community, and I think just the atmosphere we're building here. We want really family-friendly location, you know, really folks in the neighborhood, the trail, the people coming and going in the area, the flow of the city.
The size of our tap room is going to really accommodate, you know, a decent amount of people. So, we find this to be kind of the beer version of a coffee house. You know, we're going to be excited to see people come in here, parts of the community, and just, you know, we've had local people in this complex, Constitution Place, that have their businesses here say, oh, I'm going to bring clients over. We're going to have our meetings here. There's just it's just going to be a good community-centered place where people can come in, enjoy a nice craft beer. And since we're kind of communities, we're in the center of the community. We're halfway between Veterans Parkway and downtown. It just really lends itself to be a nice area to have a tap room. And I think being, you know, blocks away from Wesleyan, we've positioned ourselves well in the community, I believe.
What are some of the aspirational breweries you guys look to as models for the type of place you want to be? Like either a brewery that has a good story that you kind of attach yourself to, or you like the way they do business, you like their attitude, you like their quality. Who do you aspire to be?
I think one, White Oak, without a doubt. Brian used to have the hop shop. It's where I started getting all my stuff and hung out there. And whenever I had a problem, I went to Brian, to figure it out. And I'd say he was always really supportive and teaching and problem solving if there was a problem. Atmosphere, I think the whole craft beer tap room concept is so unique. And I love that Bloomington now has so many, and it's really starting to open up here. I know Mike and I, when we were looking at some different equipment in the past year, one place we were down in St. Louis, was it Second Shift, an amazing experience. They're in this industrial area, and we're like, are we in the right place? And we get there, and we go in this huge, wide open building, and the coolest thing was, there were guys that just got in there from a bicycle ride and stopped in. There were families playing games. There was some music going on. It was just that real family-centered, easygoing concept. It wasn't a bar. It was more of a gathering place. So, I think those two stand out in my mind. I'm originally from Buffalo, New York, and I know going back home all the time, scenes exploded there. And it's just like I said, it's so different, between Chicago and different places we've been, that it's not a bar. It's more of a comfortable place.
So what are some things you guys have done already? I've seen some stuff on social media, you guys out and about at different events, setting up a table, doing this and that. What have you done so far to increase visibility, setting up for an opening here in the spring?
The first thing we did was Brugula. That was actually, we weren't sure if we could pull it off. It was a little early in our process, but we did it, and it took a lot of work, but we did it, and I'd say we hit it with a splash. We got a lot of great feedback and a pretty decent following just from that event. After that, beer-wise, we haven't done much. We're not licensed yet. So for that event, we're on the homebrew side. But we've been trying to really stand by what we say when we always talk about community first, beer first. You know, the beer is important, but so is the community to us. And we try to make ourselves out there. We've worked with the Tool Library for building beds for kids. We were involved last week with Wine for Wishes, which was for Make-A-Wish Foundation. We worked with Guns and Hoses last week. We don't have to spend money, but we can give, you know, and not just ourselves, but, you know, we want to be able to, once we open, you know, our customers, our families, our friends, you know, we can all represent Keg Grove and help the community in any way we can.
With the opening of this, Bloomington Normal's fourth tap room, there's certainly that potential for beer tourism to come into Bloomington Normal, folks who make maybe a weekend trip where they stop at all four over the course of a couple of days. Can you guys talk a little bit about that and what it's like to be part of that potential and what hope you may have to bring people in from out of town?
I think that's part of our drive, to be honest. I think, you know, even way back when who knew that it was going to become all this, you know, in Bloomington Normal, and we really, you know, just the thought of that being a potential destination. Chicago's so big, St. Louis is so big, Peoria's got a lot going on, the Champaign area's got so much going on, and we're in the middle of all of them. It's just so amazing. I mean, Distill built this beautiful building and has this beautiful space, and people want to come and seek it out. And now there's three other breweries. Let's check them out. I mean, it's fantastic. I'm super excited. I'm excited for that.
Well, what about timelines? So what comes next after today? When should we expect the taproom to have an opening?
We're still hopeful for May. Yeah. We're still hopeful for May. We, like I said, we're currently in a couple delays, but still can achieve May.
That's Jeffrey Meraz and Mike Hoff from Keg Grove speaking with GLT's Ryan Denham inside their new brewery and tap room that's under construction in Bloomington. Their third business partner is Tyler Cox. If Keg Grove opens as expected in May, it will be the fourth new craft beer destination to open in Bloomington Normal within the past year. They follow Distill's Beer Hall and the White Oak and Little Beaver brewery tap rooms. You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Since dogs were first domesticated thousands of years ago, they have served humans in a variety of ways, from herding sheep to assisting police and the military. Dogs hold a variety of helpful jobs. Increasingly, service dogs are helping humans, assisting those with visual impairments, along with seizure disorders and PTSD. A group of students at Illinois State University have established an organization that trains the service dogs of tomorrow. Laura Kennedy has more on this edition of GLT's Animal House.
On a windy morning on the Illinois State University campus, a group of students have gathered with a very special offer for the campus community.
Support ISU service dogs. We take car, we take cash. For $1, you get to take all the pictures and cuddles you like. Donate a dollar to help ISU service dogs.
The ISU Service Dog Organization, known as Independence, is selling a chance to kiss, cuddle, or take a selfie with the canines that are being trained to become service dogs. The cuddle event raises funds for the organization, paying for everything from vet bills to food for the dogs. Junior Stephen Wright is president, and vice president is senior Marie Cook, one of the founders of the organization. As an animal science major, she saw a need at the university for a group dedicated to training the next generation of service dogs and service dog trainers.
We talked to disability concerns, the university. We did like a lot of meetings to get it all going. So, and then we officially became an RSO.
Registered Student Organization.
Yes, in March of 2013.
So tell us, what do service dogs do? Stephen, can you fill us in on what a service dog is all about?
Yes, service dogs can actually do a variety of things. There are many, many disabilities that they help out with, such as mobility, diabetes, seizures.
How does a dog help with seizures?
Scent detection.
Scent detection. So a dog can detect when someone's going to have a seizure?
Mm-hmm. They usually alert the person for seizures. When they alert the person, they get the person down on the ground, and they will usually lay across them.
To keep them safe?
To keep them safe.
That's amazing. What else do service dogs do?
They help people who have a mobile disability. Like, they go get things for them.
That's like
help them get around.
It's like Fetch Plus.
It is. And that's kind of how we train, where it's like we have them playing games to learn, and then that way they love to work.
Well, how many commands can a dog learn?
Quite a bit.
A lot.
Quite a bit. Like dozens and dozens?
Yeah. We actually have a six-month-old puppy, and he's at 47 commands already, and they can learn so much more than that. I think I've heard that one service dog one time knew actually about 1,000 different words.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. I actually saw a service dog once go and open a door, use like the handicap thing. The dog was trained to get up on his hind legs and touch the handicap, that big silver button, to open the door. And I was just gobsmacked by that. I thought that was really impressive.
Yeah, they can also open refrigerator doors, cabinets, go grab things for people. It's pretty cool.
Take off socks.
Yes.
Take off socks? So where do the dogs come from that you are training to be service dogs?
The ones we're training to be service dogs come from Paws Giving Independence in Peoria, Illinois.
Are they rescue dogs?
Yes.
Oh, that's great. So basically they're to be taking them from a bad situation and training them up and putting them in a situation to help someone.
Yeah. We've had many conversations about it. And one time they told me how they've taken dogs away that were just days away from being euthanized and made them service dogs and made them do something.
Well, how does that make you guys feel, knowing that you're involved in something like that? Marie?
It's awesome. Like, it's just very rewarding, and we're giving back to the community and saving these dogs.
What types of dogs make good service dogs? You had an event on the quad last week, and I saw quite a few poodle-type dogs and Labradors. Are they the smartest ones out there?
Poodles are a very smart breed, but really any dog, any type of breed can make a good service dog.
It just depends. Obviously, you wouldn't want to use a Chihuahua as for like mobility work.
Yeah, it depends what you're using the dog for.
Depending on what the disability is, you just have to find a specific breed for it, usually.
How long does it take to train a dog to be ready to be a service dog?
It depends on that as well. It depends on how fast the dog progresses and what you're training them for.
So how do you guys get your training? So you go over to Peoria and they train you up, and then you come back here and you train the dogs?
That's one way we started doing it. We also get a lot of advice from our advisor, Dr. Farmer, who's a canine behaviorist. On top of that, like, some of the people on the exec board will go to extra things. Like this past weekend, me and a few others went out to Cincinnati for a clicker training expo to learn more and find better ways for training the dogs.
So you're training the dogs, but you're changing not only the dogs, but you're kind of changing yourselves through doing all this training. Marie, can you tell me how you've changed working with this organization?
I've become a much more confident person. I was really, really shy when I came in as a freshman. And then since we're training a service dog and always having one with me, it's just made me like super confident, able to talk to people. It gave me a lot of leadership skills as well that I've taken and applied to other things. So yeah, it's really changed me a lot.
Steven?
I'm pretty much the same way. I came in, I was very awkward and shy. I didn't talk to people. Actually, I was in the club all freshman year without making friends because I'm just not the type of person who usually goes out of my way to talk to people. Last year, after Marie appointed me to the exec board, I started getting a lot more comfortable being able to talk to people. And then a few months later, I ran for president and was elected. And
that's quite a change from your freshman year.
It is. It is. And then since then, my speaking skills, although not always perfect, they've gotten so much better. I'm a lot more confident talking to people. I'm a lot more social now.
Do you guys see yourself working with dogs and service dogs for the rest of your lives? When you get out of college and you have your career, are you going to continue with this?
I'm not sure. I'd like to, but it kind of depends where my career path takes me.
Where are you planning on going?
I don't know yet.
Okay. What's your major?
Animal science and animal history management. I'm currently thinking of taking a year off and then going to grad school, so we'll see. I don't really know what I want to do yet.
Steven?
I would love to, at least in some way, like train dogs to continue helping people, whether it's service dogs or therapy dogs, which therapy dogs were actually one of the things that we just added this year.
Oh, so you're expanding?
Yes. Because the bottom line is we want to help people, and we want to train the dogs to do that. And therapy dogs, they help more than just one person. They help hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people.
How do they help them?
They go to places like hospitals or nursing homes where people are like old, sick, or just need comforting. A lot of times they'll either cuddle with the person by like resting their head on their lap, or sometimes give kisses, depending on the dog.
I don't know any dog that doesn't want to give kisses. I have to be honest with that. They're usually pretty flagrant with their kissing. What sort of rights do working dogs have in public?
Well, service dogs, they have access, in Illinois, they have access to everywhere. For therapy dogs, they're only allowed places that they're invited into. That's because they're not certified.
You're spending a lot of time with these dogs, training them up. From the time they're young often, or maybe they're a little bit older, but you invest a lot of time, a lot of energy in training these dogs. And then when the training is done and it's time for the dog to go become a service dog in the real world, is it tough to part with the dog?
It is very tough to part with the dog. But when they leave you, you know they're going somewhere where they're needed more. And I think that's a lot more rewarding than just keeping the dog.
Marie, can you tell me about your experience with that?
It is very difficult. I've trained two dogs. My first dog, I got him when he was 6 months old. Had him for a year here at school. And then he was almost supposed to go on to advanced training. But then recently in October, I found out he would be dropped because he has a very strong prey drive and some dog aggression. So I adopted him, and I'm going to train him as a therapy dog. And then I also had a golden retriever who I trained since he was 10 weeks old up until he was a year and a half. I recently had to part with him too, but he's still in the organization, so I get to see him all the time.
What's the most unusual command you've ever trained a dog to learn?
There's one that I taught the last dog I had called Frog. We taught her the command that we called Frog.
Okay, the command was called Frog. Okay.
Yeah. So what she would do is her back legs would just go straight out behind her. It just looked like she had frog legs.
Yes. So why would she do that? What was it in aid of?
Oh, that was just for fun. We can do those too.
That's Stephen Wright and Marie Cook of the Independence ISU Service Dog Organization. I'm Laura Kennedy.
The students of the Independence Service Dogs Organization are hosting an educational event tomorrow on the ISU campus. Learn how your pet could become a service dog, be a good canine citizen, and more at 10 a.m. in Schrader Hall, Room 130. The event is free. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, with help today from Ryan Denham, Laura Kennedy, and Charlie Schlenker. Find the full show podcast and individual stories and interviews at WGLT.org. Try the NPR One app for GLT and NPR stories. Get the app from Google Play or the Apple App Store. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.